This first half hour to 45 minutes or so this evening is going to consist of some excerpts from a book, a currently available book called Unhealed Wounds, subtitled France and the Klaus Barbie Affair. That's authored by Erna Paris, first name E-R-N-A, last name Paris, just as in Paris, France. The book was published in soft cover in 1986 by the Grove Press Incorporated, New York. And it's copyright 1985, published in soft cover by the Grove Press, New York. Now, recapping very briefly of some of the main information from Radio Free America number 22. We began Radio Free America number 22 by dealing with some interesting elements of the U.S. of the Olympics massacre that occurred in Munich, Germany in 1972. Specifically, we talked about some elements of that unfortunate event, which are not generally well known. Specifically, we took a look at the man generally credited with planning and leading that attack, a man named Ali Hassan Salameh. We took a look at the fact that within just under a year after leading the Olympics massacre, Ali Hassan Salameh was working for the Central Intelligence Agency in an anti-terrorist capacity, supposedly anyway. We also took a look at the fact that the Galen agent, the BND agent who was in charge of security for the U.S. Olympics, for the Olympics massacre in 1972, a man named Hans Langemann, was working setting up agent provocateur groups with a former head of the West German Federal Police named Hans Kollmar, last name K-O-L-L-M-A-R. Langemann, by the way, is L-A-N-G-E-M-A-N-N. And Ali Hassan Salameh, A-L-I-H-A-S-S-A-N-S-A-L-A-M-E-H is the spelling on that. We also took a look, at, in Radio Free America number 22, at a degree of historical continuity between elements of the Palestinian movement, which had been affiliated with the Third Reich even before the Second World War, and we traced some of these elements up through the Palestinian terrorist movement and through the Olympics massacre of 1972. That's not to say that by any means all Palestinians or all elements of the PLO are terrorists or connected with the Nazi underground or the U.S. and Western intelligence apparatus, but many elements of them are. It's worth noting in this context that the PLO is a very diverse organization, highly fractionalized, and in fact many of the elements are at bitter odds with each other. Elements of that of the PLO are affiliated, however, with the U.S. intelligence system, and there, in turn, the U.S. intelligence system has acquired many of these elements from the many of the elements of the Palestinian movement that had been traditionally associated with the Third Reich. Now, Ali Hassan Salameh, the fellow who led the Olympics massacre, was associated with George Habash's PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the same fellow who went to work for the CIA, has been associated through his family with a man named Hajjamin al-Husseini. Hajjamin al-Husseini, who we're going to talk about some more this evening, was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and later he went to work for the Third Reich as a major in the SS. Among the people who worked very closely with Hajjamin al-Husseini was Hassan Salameh. Hassan Salameh is the father of Ali Hassan Salameh, the leader of the Olympics massacre. Hassan Salameh worked as a commando during the Third Reich, and then fought, along with Hajjamin al-Husseini, against Israel following the establishment of the State of Israel. Later, Ali Hassan Salameh, his son, married a woman from the family of Hajjamin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti, former Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, spiritual leader of all Palestinian Muslims for a time, and eventually, as we indicated, a major in the SS. As I also indicated, the chief of security for the Olympics massacre, Hans Langemann, a member of the Galen organization, the Nazi Eastern Front intelligence outfit which jumped to the CIA at the end of World War II, began working later with Hans Kollmar, head of the Bundeskriminalamt, the West German Federal Police, as setting up basically what appeared to have been agent provocateur groups. He was setting up terrorist groups, ostensibly for the purpose of infiltrating terrorist groups in Germany. Indications were, however, that this group, supposedly to infiltrate terrorists, had in fact established terrorist incidents themselves. We're going to begin picking up sort of where we left off at that time, and we're going to take a look at some interesting connecting elements between the post-World War II Nazi underground, some Nazi intelligence operations which were run out of the Galen organization, the Nazi spy outfit that jumped to the CIA at the end of World War II, and we're going to connect many of these elements up with not only Palestinian terrorism, but with terrorism in general, and terrorism going on to this very day, some elements which are active to the moment. We're going to begin by taking a look at two individuals named Jacques Verges, last name V-E-R-G-E-S, J-A-C-Q-U-E-S is how his first name is spelled, and also a very, very important man named François Genoud, G-E-N-O-U-D is his last name. Of course, François is F-R-A-N-C-O-I-S. Now, reading now from the book Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. We're going to begin by taking a look at Jacques Verges and his relationship with François Genoud, and we're going to begin taking a look also at just who François Genoud is. Reading from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. It was June 15th, 1983. Jacques Verges had become Klaus Barbie's sole legal counsel. Interrupting, of course, Klaus Barbie was the SS captain from Lyon and later U.S. intelligence agent who was extradited to France in early 1983. Continuing, Verges merely smiled mysteriously when asked who was paying his fees and his expenses for trips to faraway places like La Paz, Bolivia, to collect evidence and interview witnesses. François Genoud, on the other hand, was slightly less reticent. In an interview with Stern magazine, he said that he would, quote, neither confirm nor deny, unquote, his involvement in the Barbie affair, adding that, quote, everyone has his hobbies, unquote. Among Verges's acquaintances, however, the answer seemed evident, quote, if Jacques needs money these days, he has only to go to Switzerland, confided a friend. It has long been known in various European circles that, quote, a Swiss citizen who lives in Lausanne, L-A-U-S-A-N-N-E, has managed the Nazi treasury since the fall of the Third Reich. The money, most of which was stolen from European Jews, was deposited in numbered bank accounts through a clandestine club of former SS officers called Die Spinne, the Spider, the successor to the Odessa organization. In March of 1965, Le Monde indirectly identified this individual as François Genoud. In 1969, the Centre d'Information et de Documentation Moyen-Orient in Brussels confirmed the identification. By the way, that would be the Centre of Information and Documentation for the Middle East, translating from the French. Recapping the important aspect of the last section, François Genoud basically was the person who has controlled from Swiss bank accounts the post-World War II Nazi treasury. The Nazis had anticipated their defeat long before the end of the war and stashed away a great deal of capital for the financing of post-war Nazi activities, something which has sort of unfortunately been relegated to the realm of pulp fiction, but which is in fact a very real and current reality. Continuing with Unhealed Wounds, François Genoud personifies a hybrid of ultra-left and neo-Nazi extremism that first appeared on the international scene after the last war. One might even say he created the type along with a handful of others. His Nazism came first. Genoud was born in Lausanne in 1915 into a bourgeois family that appreciated law and order, unquote. In the early 1930s, before Hitler came to power, his parents sent him to Germany in the hope that he would pick up some of the discipline of the emerging new regime. During his stay, Genoud was introduced to Hitler and actually shook his hand. He read Hitler's writings and found them very relevant, unquote. The teenager was an instant convert. François Genoud returned to Switzerland a convinced Nazi, and he has never lost his faith. Back in Switzerland, Genoud made contact with Georges Ultramare, O-L-T-R-A-M-A-R-E, the head of the Swiss fascist party, L'Union Nationale. According to his own account, however, Genoud preferred the pro-Nazi Front National, which he joined in 1934. In 1936, he traveled to Palestine, where he met an individual who, like himself, would eventually combine the presumably polar opposites of fascism and extreme left-wing nationalism. Haji Amin al-Hussein was the ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and he was to become one of Genoud's links to the Arab world. In 1940, the military attaché at the French embassy in Bern, Switzerland, noted that Genoud was involved in disseminating anti-French propaganda. Also around this time, Genoud was contacted by an agent of the Abwehr, by the way, that was the German military intelligence service during World War II, beginning again. Also around this time, Genoud was contacted by an agent of the Abwehr for work in the German intelligence service. And during the course of the year, he disappeared from Switzerland to travel through Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Belgium. During this period, and immediately following the end of the war, Genoud made the acquaintance of several extremely prominent Nazis, including SS General Karl Wolff, W-O-L-F-F. Wolff was Himmler's personal adjutant as far back as 1933, and in 1939, he became Hitler's liaison officer in the Führer's headquarters. In 1943, Wolf was supreme SS and police leader in the Italian campaign, and it was he who negotiated surrender on April 29, 1945. He was also part of Hitler's plan, later abandoned, to kidnap Pope Pius XII in September of 1943, after the fall of Mussolini, with a special regiment of 2,000 men. Wolf was a consummate Nazi. According to a document submitted to the court at Nuremberg in 1946, he had greeted, quote, with particular joy, unquote, the information that, for 2 weeks now, a train has been carrying every day 5,000 members of the chosen people from Warsaw to the killing center at Treblinka. In 1984, just before his death at the age of 84, Wolf gave an interview to a Swiss journalist in which he spoke of how much former Nazis everywhere owed to François Genoux. After the war, while they were in prison or in hiding, Genoux acted as an intermediary, Wolf said. In particular, he was involved in bringing aid to German soldiers and officers who were being held in French prisons. Genoux claims that he was not involved in helping Nazis escape from Europe, but only, quote, because the occasion did not present itself, unquote. On another occasion, he explained himself further, this time with regard to Klaus Barbie. I did not help Mr. Barbie escape, he declared. It would not have been a dishonor to help National Socialists flee, but as it happens, I did not, unquote. As part of his ongoing commitment to the ideology of the Third Reich, Genoux became a publisher of important Nazi materials. He holds all posthumous rights to the writings of Hitler, Martin Bormann, and the Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, according to a financial agreement concluded with members of all three families in 1945 and 6. In 1952, representing himself as an agent of the Hitler family, Genoux brought charges against a Paris publishing house that had produced Bormann's account of Hitler's conversations without his permission and won. And in 1956, a court in Cologne agreed that he owned the rights to the posthumous works of Goebbels, causing a scandal among people who claimed that the royalties from such writings ought to be in the public domain to compensate Hitler's victims. In 1973, Genoux sold the rights to the Goebbels diary, a 16,000-page manuscript with a Baroque history of its own, to Albrecht Naus, last name K-N-A-U-S, the director of Hoffmann und Kampf Verlag, a Hamburg publishing house, and in 1981 Naus, who by then had his own publishing house in Hamburg, brought out Hitler's Political Testament, as purportedly dictated to Martin Bormann. The preface to the book explained that Genoux had acquired the document in 1946 at the time of the Nuremberg trials. It seems that ex-SS Captain Hans Reichenberg, R-E-I-C-H-E-N-B-E-R-G, who had the document, went to the Nuremberg trials to act as an advisor for the defense. There, through his former superior, General Hermann Rahmke, R-A-M-C-K-E, he met François Genoux, a friend of Rahmke. During the course of a developing friendship, he confided to Genoux his photocopies of 18 chapters of the book. By 1955, Genoux's second career as advisor, researcher, and banker to the cause of Arab nationalism had begun. One of the keys to that seemingly unlikely transition can be found in Hitler's Political Testament. In the preface, Genoux explained that he planned to have the book translated into Arabic and Swahili because in the body of the text, Hitler invited the people of the Third World to carry on the work of the Thousand Year Reich. Let me repeat that last sentence. In the preface, Genoux explained that he planned to have the book translated into Arabic and Swahili because in the body of the text, Hitler invited the people of the Third World to carry on the work of the Thousand Year Reich. In 1955, Genoux was in Tangiers, one of the ports where Nazis seeking to escape European justice took refuge. He was also frequently in Cairo, where he worked in the Egyptian intelligence service under Nasser. Cairo under Nasser had been the center of the pan-Arab movement since 1945. These were important years, the years in which Nazism and the developing ultra-left began to merge, and François Genoux was at the center of events. With his friend Hans Reichenberg, who also had discovered a new outlet for his career in the Arab world, Genoux created an import-export company called Arabo Africa. As A-R-A-B-O and Africa A-F-R-I-K-A. The business was primarily a cover for the export of anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli propaganda and the delivery of weapons to the Algerian FLN movement. Genoux made financial investments for various friends, Hans Reichenberg and Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, S-C-H-A-C-H-T, Hitler's finance minister, among them. Genoux also renewed his friendship with Karl Wolf, who had found his way to Nasser's Egypt. Cairo in the 1950s was paradise for Nazis with nowhere to go and nowhere to apply their carefully honed talents. In the emerging world of Arab nationalism, they found a new outlet for their profound anti-Semitism and their propaganda skills. It was in this milieu that François Genoux first met the nine leaders of the nascent Algerian insurrection. Ahmed Ben Bella, Mohamed Kider, K-H-I-D-E-R, Ait Ahmet, A-I-T-A-H-M-E-T, Mohamed Boudiaf, B-O-U-D-I-A-F, and their colleagues had formed the Provisional Government of Algeria. Genoux's skills as a financier made him infinitely valuable, and before the end of the decade, he had established bank accounts in Switzerland on behalf of the North African Liberation Armies of Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria. The system he used involved multiple signatures, just like the system that was already in use for secret Nazi funds. Let's go back and recap some of the important aspects of this particular passage. First of all, François Genoux was reportedly the fellow, and there's a lot of information to support this, who had been providing much of the financing for Jacques Verger, the lawyer, the defense attorney, for Klaus Barbie in his impending trial in France. As we've seen, François Genoux was an avid Nazi, worked very closely with Nazi intelligence before and during World War II. After the war, he not only became the heir to a great many Nazi documents, such as Hitler's political testament, he also, and perhaps more importantly, became the key Nazi banker, that is, the man controlling and dispersing the massive funds secreted away by the Nazis during the course of World War II in anticipation of their impending defeat. We've also taken a look at how, prior to the war, François Genoux became acquainted with Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and SS officer who figures so prominently in the milieu that emerges in connection with the Olympics massacre. We've also taken a look at how François Genoux traveled to the Middle East and was very active in Egypt and worked in the Egyptian intelligence service, and then became a key financier also for the emerging Arab nationalist movement. Now, this is a very key connection because, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 22, our program about the Olympics massacre, the Egyptian intelligence service, as did the Libyan intelligence service after it, had its origins with a group of Nazi war criminals dispatched for the express purpose of forming these intelligence services, and that those Nazi war criminals were acting on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency. Specifically, Nasser had requested help from the CIA in forming not only his general staff, but his intelligence service, since the CIA had connections with Israel, did not want to alienate Israel by sending any of their regular agents. They turned to Galen, who dispatched a bunch of Nazi war criminals, most of them virulent anti-Semites. This group put together the Egyptian Intelligence Service, and later the Libyan Intelligence Service. That group was headed up by Otto Skorzeny, a major in the SS, actually a colonel in the SS, and a fellow who was basically in charge of commando training for the Third Reich. Skorzeny, in many ways, could be said to be the grandfather or the godfather of modern terrorism. Skorzeny, ultimately, or at least nominally, was headed up all commando training for the Third Reich, as I said, and in that capacity, at least in terms of chain of command, had to have had Hassan Salame under his command. Hassan Salame had worked in an abortive commando mission to establish an Arab uprising in then British-held Palestine as a way to siphon off British strength from the impending Nazi offensive in the Battle of the Bulge, or what became the Battle of the Bulge once the engagement began. It's interesting that François Genoux was working for this Nazi intelligence group because, as we looked at in a book called Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield, it was while heading up this Nazi intelligence group in Egypt that Otto Skorzeny set up the first Palestinian commando groups which operated in the Gaza Strip. The first Palestinian terrorists were set up by Otto Skorzeny, according to Infield, while working on behalf of CIA and Galen in this area. So we have François Genoux hooking up with this milieu right at this point. We'll take a short break, and then we'll continue with the information we're presenting. Welcome back. After a musical break, we're going to be continuing with our supplement, Radio Free America number 22, reading from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. The next piece of information we're going to take a look at concerns the first Conference of Third World Nations in Bandung, Indonesia. That's Bandung. We're going to pick up the story, the thread of this historical connection that we're looking at that point. Reading once again from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. In 1939, Amin al-Hussein, the ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, took refuge from the British, escaped to Germany, and attached himself and his followers to the Nazi cause. Heinrich Himmler, the SS chief, was delighted. It wasn't every day that a regiment of sympathetic Muslims joined the German war movement. Himmler respected the Mufti and often complimented him on his blue eyes, which he liked to describe as appropriately Nordic. But it was in a written note to the Mufti that Himmler eventually struck a chord that would resound as a leitmotif for the future and survive four decades to influence the context of the Klaus Barbie affair. Quote, "The struggle against Judaism is at the very heart of the natural alliance between National Socialism and those Arab Muslims who burn with a desire for freedom," he wrote. "This alliance will endure until a final victory," unquote. In 1955, the Mufti resurfaced at the seminal conference at Bandung, Indonesia, where the idea of the Third World first took hold. 29 countries from Africa and Asia, representing more than one half of the world's population, sent delegates to discuss common problems with an emphasis on colonialism. Among the Arab countries, however, hatred of Israel quickly emerged as a common theme. The representative from Iraq spoke of, quote, "the force of evil," unquote, and called Zionism, quote, "one of the blackest, most somber chapters in human history," unquote. Nasser had a few choice words to say in a similar vein. But the most surprising and convincing polemic of all came from Amin al-Hussein, who arrived on a surprise visit as the representative of Yemen, a country he had apparently never seen, and proceeded to reveal... One second, I've got to skip past the plates here. Proceeded to reveal to the collected constituents that the real ambition of Israel was to annex the entire Middle East. The significance here, of course, in light particularly of, according to François Genoux, Hitler's desire that the Third World should carry on his struggle against Judaism, is that the former SS man, Haj Amin al-Husseini, should emerge in a key capacity at the seminal conference forming the notion of the Third World, or the concept and functioning milieu of the Third World. So we have Haj Amin al-Husseini, an associate of François Genoux, at the Bandung conference and apparently functioning in a key capacity. And apparently also, the Grand Mufti, in the next section of Unhealed Wounds that we're going to look at, was instrumental in drawing much of the post-World War II neo-Nazi movement and some of the surviving Third Reich veterans into an alliance with elements of the Palestinian movement against Israel. Returning to Unhealed Wounds. In April of 1969, a Congress of the neo-Nazi Neue Europäische Ordnung was held in Barcelona with 50 delegates from Europe and Latin America, most of them former SS officers, nostalgic Vichyists, and Franco supporters. The Vichy French, of course, were the French fascists who governed on behalf of the Nazis in France. The new European order had been a strictly Nazi-oriented outfit, but now, 15 years later, the focus of their international meeting was the Palestinians. Yasser Arafat sent a representative from El Fatah to explain the needs of the PLO and present two requests. The first concerned the need to recruit non-Arabs for sabotage operations, fundraising, arms supply, and the mobilizing of mercenaries and foreign instructors for training camps. The second request was for money for the dissemination of anti-Zionist propaganda in Europe and South America, including a wider distribution of the protocols. The El Fatah representative convinced several former Nazis to work directly for the cause. Karl Vandeput, V-A-N-D-E, capital P-U-T, a Belgian who had served Germany in the Africa Corps, offered to recruit young Europeans with military experience for El Fatah. Former Nazi officer Johann N. Schuller, S-C-H-U-L-L-E-R, was already involved in arms sales to El Fatah. He had also begun to recruit former Nazi officers as instructors in El Fatah guerrilla training camps. Even the ubiquitous ex-Grand Mufti of Jerusalem turned up in discussion. It was announced that he had recently formed a new unit of sabotage. Palestinian leaders began advertising in the National Zeitung in Munich, asking for volunteer war correspondents, unquote, with tank experience, unquote, to fight Zionist imperialism. By the late 1960s, satellite television was able to transmit events all over the globe, rendering the possibilities for propaganda almost limitless. Quote, "We think that killing one Jew far from the field of battle is far more effective than killing 100 Jews on the field of battle because it attracts more attention," unquote, Dr. Habash confided several years later in an interview with Oriana Fallaci. Dr. Habash, by the way, is George Habash, the head of the Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Popular Front, the PFLP. It is worth noting that he spoke of Jews, unquote, and not Zionists, unquote, as the target of terrorism. Before 1970, his PFLP had hijacked several foreign planes in full view of an international audience and blown up four, killing Jews and Gentiles alike. Next, we're going to move on to some of the direct connections between Jacques Vergès, François Genoux Verger, the radical lawyer who also has strong connections to the Palestinian movement, who defended, is defending, apparently, Klaus Barbie. François Genoux, of course, the Nazi sympathizer and during and post-World War II Nazi activist, and the man who controls not only the post-World War II Nazi treasury, according to this book, but also was instrumental in funding and handling the financing for the international Palestinian movement and Palestinian terrorism in particular. A reporter from Haaretz, this is when Jacques Berger was in Israel. Oh, actually, I'm going to skip down in this section. This is incorrectly marked here. Returning once again to Unhealed Wounds. In December of 1968 and February of 1969, PFLP terrorists hijacked El Al planes in Athens and Zurich, respectively, and at their subsequent trial in Winterthur, Switzerland, they chose Jacques Verger as their legal counsel. Although he was once again refused permission to participate, Verger went anyway as an advisor. Also present as an advisor, unquote, was François Genoux. The possibilities for propaganda at the Winterthur trial, by the way, Winterthur is W-I-N-T-E-R-T-H-U-R, beginning again, the possibilities for propaganda at the Winterthur trial were too important to be left to amateurs. There were international press conferences, and an anti-Zionist brochure called The White Book was widely circulated. The defense was paid by the Banque Commerciale Arabe, which had by then adopted the Palestinians primarily on the recommendation of Ali Hassan Salome, otherwise known as Abu Hassan, the leader of the Black September terrorist cell that was later responsible for the murder of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. Abu Hassan lived in Switzerland, where he had established an easy friendship with François Genoux. I'm going to read that last couple of sentences again because it's key and it ties in many of the elements that we're discussing this evening with the gut information from Radio Free America 22. The defense was paid by the Banque Commerciale Arabe, which had by then adopted the Palestinians primarily on the recommendation of Ali Hassan Salome, otherwise known as Abu Hassan, the leader of the Black September terrorist cell that was later responsible for the murder of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. Abu Hassan lived in Switzerland, where he had established an easy friendship with François Genoux. In 1982, Genoux publicly acknowledged his deep involvement with El Fatah. In fact, he had long looked after their European operations from every point of view. He gave advice regarding the investing of huge amounts of money donated to the cause, not least from Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who contributed $50 million to the PLO after the Munich assassinations. He provided legal counsel for Fatah men who needed help in Switzerland and underwrote other costs, including at least a partial subsidizing of a multinational terrorist organization that had set up shop in Paris, first under the leadership of Mohamed Boudia, who was murdered by the Israeli Secret Service in 1973, then under Carlos the Jackal. He was, in his own words, quote, an economic counselor with a special interest in the developmental problems of the Third World, unquote. Indeed, his interest in developmental problems, unquote, led him to continue his business dealings as an arms merchant specializing in sales to the Palestinians. Well, of course, the significance of these passages, we not only have Jacques Verger and François Genoux connected up with the PFLP, a group with which Ali Hassan Salome was also affiliated, but we have direct connections here between Ali Hassan Salome, the leader of the Olympics massacre, son of a Nazi intelligence agent, associate of the Grand Mufti, with François Genoux, the post-World War II Nazi banker and literary tract controller, I guess you could say, to coin a phrase. We also have Genoux handling funds apparently dispersed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, and also handling the defense and the subsidizing for the trials of terrorists associated with Carlos the Jackal. Well, of course, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's terrorist organization, as we looked at in Radio Free America and others, in Radio Free America number 4 and other shows, the terrorist training for Gaddafi came from Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson, the, quote, ex, unquote, CIA agents who were so very much involved with arming the Gaddafi machine. Incidentally, Frank Turple also boasted of training Carlos the Jackal, and as we looked at in Radio Free America number 4, Carlos the Jackal's life, apparently, according to Jack Anderson, was saved by the CIA. So there's an interesting connection there. On top of that, of course, we have the association of Muammar Gaddafi in a group called the Internationale Fascista, which is just as its name implies, an international fascist terrorist combine, and the co-bankroller of the Paladin mercenary group, one of the main elements of the Internationale Fascista, was none other than Otto Skorzeny working with Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. So Gaddafi and Skorzeny. Skorzeny setting up Gaddafi's secret service and work, of course, setting up the original Palestinian terrorists associated later with Gaddafi in the Paladin Mercenary Group. And we have, of course, this same milieu now intersecting directly with François Genoux and Jacques Verger, Barbie's defense attorney. Continuing now with unhealed wounds. But it was 1982, before the connections between the Palestinian left and the Nazi right resurfaced anew, and once again, Jacques Verger was a principal player in the drama. So was his old friend, François Genoux. The case concerned the Paris trial of two terrorists known as the Friends of Carlos, unquote. Bruno Breguet, B-R-E-G-U-E-T, a 12-year veteran of pro-Palestinian terrorist action, and Magdalena Kopp, K-O-P-P, formerly of the Baader-Meinhof band, had been intercepted by the Paris police while carrying grenades and guns and 4 kilos of explosives in a borrowed car that was parked just off the Champs-Élysées. Jacques Verger was their lawyer and public apologist. Bruno Breguet had been on the terror circuit for more than a decade. In 1970, at the age of 20, the young Swiss had been sent by George Habash to plant a bomb in the Israeli port of Haifa. He was caught with dynamite on his person and jailed in Israel. But the most intriguing fact about the young left-wing revolutionary was that he became a protege of his fellow countryman François Genoux, a Nazi. Genoux later acknowledged his relationship with the PFLP. He corrected a journalist who had written that he had no connection, unquote, by saying that he, quote, had no particular connection, unquote, but had met Habash one or two times, again, unquote. In 1970, when the original Bruno Breguet case broke in Israel, Genoux, who was, in his own words, very available, traveled to Breguet's hometown of Tessin, Switzerland, to meet with the young man's family. Quote, they were lovely people, he recalled with the mildness of a fond uncle. I tried to help them. Help consisted once again of advice, unquote, and the recommendation of a young lawyer who later became Genoux's son-in-law. Quote, I was quite taken by the youth of this fellow citizen who had participated in this fair a little bit like a Boy Scout. At a time when so many young people didn't care about anything at all, he set off to do something interesting, recalled Genoux. According to Le Monde, Genoux paid for Breguet's legal costs and set up a support committee on his behalf. Given his relationship as a banker to the FLN, that's the Algerian Independence Movement, by the way, and his connections with Al-Fatah and the PFLP, providing such financing was perfectly consistent behavior for Genoux. Breguet was sentenced to 15 years in prison in Israel, but released after 7 following a vigorous publicity and lobbying campaign conducted by the Breguet Support Committee. His first free act was to visit Lausanne to thank his benefactor. Genoux was vague about their subsequent relationship. Quote, I've seen him a few times since his release from prison. Sometimes he sends me a postcard, he allowed. Bruno Breguet resumed his activities. By the 1970s, he too was involved in assisting the PLO in Europe through the Carlos Network. Let me repeat that last sentence. By the late 1970s, he too was involved in assisting the PLO in Europe through the Carlos Network. When the Breguet Kopp case came to trial in 1982, it was widely believed that François Genoux had once again paid Breguet's legal costs with money that had, after all, been earmarked for aid to the Palestinian cause. Breguet was a member of the PFLP, and Genoux was a longtime supporter of the same organization. Breguet had also lived in Berlin for a period during the 1970s, where he had easy access to the neo-Nazi groups that were dear to the heart of his benefactor. According to writer Claire Sterling, Genoux helped finance the Carlos Network in Paris in the early 1970s. 10 years later, it became evident that Bruno Breguet and Magdalena Kopp worked in the same network. In February of 1982, Carlos sent a letter to the French embassy in The Hague demanding the release of Breguet and Kopp. Quote, You have arrested members of my organization, he wrote by way of information. Carlos gave the French government 1 month to accede to his request, but the letter was leaked to the press, and naturally the government refused. There was no hard evidence to connect the events, but 4 days after the deadline expired, a bomb exploded on the Paris-Toulouse train, killing 5 people. The following day, the French Cultural Center in Beirut was damaged. On April 15th, a French military officer and his pregnant wife were shot at point-blank range when they opened the door to their apartment in Beirut. On April 18th, 2 bombs exploded simultaneously in Vienna, one at the Air France head office, the other in the garden of the French embassy. So recapping the significance of this, basically we have 2 associates, Bruno Breguet and Magdalena Kopp, European terrorists associated apparently with Carlos the Jackal, who we spoke about earlier, and they in turn are being defended by not only Jacques Berger, but their defense is being financed by François Genoux, the post-World War II Nazi master, so to speak, or finance master, I guess would be a better way of putting it. Once again, we're going to take a short break, a short musical break, and then we're going to come back and finish up the section, this first section of the prepared portion for this evening.